building safe, secure, and modern schools in Duval County. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a good weekend out there. Just ahead as we kick off the week, we've got the latest on the ramped up push for that half-cent sales tax to support local schools. What are your questions about this? It will be on your ballot. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, Jacksonville's deep ties to the birth of Southern Rock, all in the pages of a fascinating new book. That's later, but first this hour, the latest on the pandemic. Florida recorded 9 deaths Sunday from coronavirus. Now, that's the second fewest this month, and luckily none in our area. However, the positivity rate for the disease is up to its highest level since September 10th. It's above 6.2%. Children, of course, are back to school amidst this ongoing pandemic, and often they're going to class in buildings around town that have fallen into disrepair. They don't always have good ventilation either, and that is not good for flattening the curve of the virus spread. So, 4 former superintendents from the Duval County Public Schools have banded together, and they are publicly urging voters to support the half-cent sales tax referendum that will build up and repair safe, secure, and modern schools in Duval County. Now, this half-penny measure will be on your ballot in November. Early voting starts in just a few weeks. Right now, we're pleased to welcome 2 former school superintendents from Duval County. Ed Pratt Daniels is on the line. Hi, Ed.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you on the show. And former superintendent Patricia Willis. Patricia, good to have you as well.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning to both of you. Here's our question to callers. Where do you stand on the half penny for schools? Will you support it or not? What are your thoughts? It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInjax. And our Facebook page is open. Ed Pratt Daniels, I'm going to begin with you because, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you're the most recently serving superintendent of the 4 of you that authored a guest column in Sunday's Times Union, who is still living in Jacksonville. So if I could begin with you, why did you feel it necessary to speak out publicly and urge voters to support this half-cent referendum?
Well, we've known for a number of years, spanning back even before my superintendency, that we had a huge backlog of maintenance problems. Roofs, windows replacing, ceilings, lighting, and especially with the need for modern technology and wireless in buildings, we had a huge backlog as I came into the superintendency in 2007. At that time, we were hitting the recession, and the state legislature reduced our local capital millage from 2 mills to 1.5 mills. And what that meant was that we were receiving substantially less, $30 million a year less from what we had before, which was already inadequate. So since that time, we would have had $300 million more dollars to take care of some of the issues that we have. And we have the oldest schools in the state, 44 years average years of age.
And some much older than that, some close to 100 years old, right?
Oh, yeah, that's the average. So for every one that's 24 years old, we got one that's 64 years old. And so there's a study that's done called the FCI, Facilities Cost Index. And when you get to a certain percent, 70, 80%, it's more cost-wise smart to replace that school rather than to continue to patch it. I remember during my superintendency, sometimes we had air conditioning systems go down, and we didn't have the money to replace the whole system. So we had to go out and scour for parts that were very difficult to find because the units were so old. And that's the situation we've been in. And so we've banded together to support this effort that we believe our students, teachers, and staff deserve safe, secure, and modern facilities.
You can read this column in the newspaper, also authoring it, Superintendents Zenke and Fryer. And on the line now, former school superintendent Patricia Willis. Patricia, as we learn from your op-ed and also at the website DuvalCBS.com, that's Citizens for Better Schools, kids are going to school in dilapidated buildings. Often they don't have working air conditioning. Schools often flood out because of faulty sprinkler systems. Lots of classrooms have no windows. One school in town actually has a sinking foundation. Hundreds of kids are in portables, so they are more at risk from a potential shooter. I mean, it's just a slew of issues. When voters go to the polls in November, and we expect high turnout because it is a presidential election cycle, they will be asked to vote this up or down. Polling shows the majority of people around Duval County support this measure. That said, what's your message to the voters who are just learning about this?
Thank you, Melissa. My message to the voters is that this is really, our teachers and our students, frankly, deserve better. And our teachers are working hard, students are working hard, even as they are working now. Duval County Public Schools is only one half or 1% away from that A school grade that they've been striving for. 55% of our schools are A or B, and we have an 85% graduation rate. And even with that, the learning environment is critical. And so with the work that they've been doing so far, we know that they deserve so much more. In serving in my role as interim superintendent, I happened to be serving during the Parkland shooting. After that, we started to look at our schools, another look at the safety and security of our schools and how do we harden these schools. It was costly and certainly a struggle to try to harden these schools that are outdated, to bring update those schools and put in the security and infrastructure that's needed to protect our students. And this was just February 14, 2018. And so we still have a struggle. And knowing, because we've lived it, as Mr. Pradano has said, we've lived in this space. And we understand the critical importance of having a building that's important for our children to be able to do well. Frankly, someone did it for us. And it's our turn now as community members to do the same for our students and for our school.
And Ed Pratt-Daniels, as people who visit your website will learn, impact fees won't work for this. The city doesn't use them for new construction. People ask about the lottery all of the time. The state mandates almost all lottery funds be used for specific programs, not maintenance, renovation, or school construction. That's why voters in Tampa, Orlando, Clay County, and St. John's County have invested in their students and schools through a similar local referendum that the voters in Duval County will be asked to consider. Ed Pratt-Daniels, what's your response to emails and tweets we're already getting about how this money will be apportioned for public schools versus charter schools? Part of the reason this took so long to make it to the ballot is because of controversy over that. Your thoughts?
Well, the issue was resolved at the legislative level this past spring, where the legislature directed school districts to portion out the money based on numbers of students, which was one of the positions advocated by some of our charter operators. And so they're going to get a prorated share based on the number of students they have. And that will be paid out as we receive the funds through the half-cent revenue.
Let's go to some calls.
So they're going to be more than well taken care of.
Okay. All right. Let's go to some calls now. 549-2937 as we talk about the half penny, the half cent sales tax for local schools. It will be on your November ballot. You can vote it up or down. Lise in Jacksonville. Lise, good morning.
Good morning. I'm very disappointed to hear that legislation passed allowing charter schools to participate in this funding. It really deserves to go to the public schools.
Okay, thank you for that. Patricia Willis, it's a done deal, but what's your response to listeners out there who don't like the way that this played out?
Well, I certainly understand that there will be community members who don't like the way that it's playing out, but and as much as I could hear just a little bit of the a caller saying that she didn't like it. I didn't hear the rest of that, but we understand that. We just try to encourage them that the
she would like it all to go to public schools is what she basically said.
Oh, okay. I did miss that part. But I will tell you that when we think about our city as a whole, and that we have seen the landscape of public education change over the years, many of our children are in our charter schools, and so we have to indeed partner with our students who move between these schools, and so that all of our children belong to us, that we certainly understand where the legislature is on this. And so we will just continue to move forward to move this legislation, at least to get the referendum passed.
549-2937. Dave is along Roosevelt Boulevard. Hi, Dave. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is this. Since sales taxes tend to disproportionately affect people on the lower incomes, Why wouldn't you instead essentially go where the money is? That is, raise the homestead exemption and increase property taxes.
Thanks for that, Dave. Ed Pratt Daniels, I know that argument has come up in the past. It didn't make its way through the process, but what are your thoughts about that?
Well, the homestead exemption is established at the state level, I believe, in the state constitution. And so that's not something that the local district would have any control over.
What about just a millage rate increase with some of those funds being used
in
this manner?
Part of the issue with the millage rate is that it is maybe more progressive as a tax, there are a number of people who would not be paying that tax. And one advantage of the sales tax is that everyone who comes to Duval County and spends money, whether or not they're from another county locally or if they're coming through here to visit, they're helping pay that sales tax. And so we really get a broader base of number of people who participate in it.
I'm looking at your website. Actually, it's not your website per se, but the website on this. There are a couple of them. It's DuvalCBS.com. That stands for Citizens for Better Schools. And according to the numbers, a family of four with an income of $55,000 a year, that's the median income in Duval County, will pay an estimated $64 a year. Necessities like groceries, medicine, and gas will not be taxed. Large purchases like a car, the first $5,000 of that would be subject to the half penny, meaning you'd pay an extra $25. So I hope that gives folks a little bit of an idea of how this will be paid by all of us. Tim is on the UNF campus. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to, of course, offer my support for the half-cent sales tax. I am somewhat disappointed also that the charter schools are going to result in it being spread even thinner, particularly to the schools that desperately need it, our almost 100-year-old schools. But I wanted to offer a little bit of historical context as to why and how we got so badly underfunded. A lot of it can be traced back to the 1950s and 1960s when Ish Brandt was our last elected superintendent, and one of his big efforts to get reelect is, I'll keep your taxes low or keep your taxes low. Well, you get what you pay for, and he got reelected. He served four terms as an elected superintendent. But if you look at a lot of the schools that were built during that time, we had a lot less revenue, and so that was we didn't get what we needed. Quite simply, that's also what led to the schools losing accreditation in the 1960s. One of the key findings in the research by the accrediting agencies was the schools, there just wasn't enough funding. Everything stemmed back to underfunding of the schools.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, everybody in a community benefits in the long term from good public education. And everybody needs to support this, and I feel like if they're not supporting this, they're either short-sighted, or I would even say being a bit selfish. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Tim. Anthony on the north side. Hello, Anthony.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just don't understand, you're asking the citizens to pay more, which I don't mind doing, for public schooling. But these charter schools, they're schools for profit. And why should we continue to pay more money and, you know, to charter schools who are already in it for profit instead of, you know, like, hey, taking care of our public schools, which are in shambles. They're falling apart. I don't get it.
Right. And Patricia Willis, as we've been explaining, the legislature resolved that issue because there were certainly a number of charter school proponents in the Florida legislature, and they have engineered a carve-out, so to speak, for charter schools. You know, we're hearing some frustration from some listeners out there about this because they see how nice and new a lot of the charter schools are and how old and crumbling a lot of the public schools are. Now, to give fair voice to the other side, charter school parents and teachers and students say that, you know, that they are public schools too and that they want to be well maintained for years into the future. But what do you say to a caller like that who's really frustrated about this state of affairs?
Well, I do understand that frustration and the as you say, the sharing of the funds. However, in that the legislation has taken care of that, and we certainly, for whatever, you know, the reasons that they've determined that we have to do that, we would not want the public schools that are not charter schools to be penalized, to not have be able to take advantage of the push that we have for the halfpenny tax for these public schools that really are in great, great need based on age and the buildings that are, frankly, many are dilapidated, and we understand that. But however, you know, again, as Ms. Pratt Downer mentioned, the legislation kind of took care of that for us, and we certainly are going to move forward because we don't want our schools that are public schools that are not charter to be penalized because of it.
Jim tweets the show, has Duval County gotten their air conditioning issues worked out yet? Faulty air conditioners add to COVID concerns. Well, the answer is not yet. They would need this money to do that. Another tweet from Jimmy Midyet. He is a candidate for the clerk of courts. I'm in favor of the half-cent referendum. I'm a proud product of the Duval County Public Schools, and I know how critical our neighborhood schools are for the success of young people. He says it's a shame we had to wait an extra year for this referendum, but better late than never. On our Facebook page, Paula says, anyone not in favor of this needs to be quiet. They've already demonstrated that they don't care about the well-being of children. From JP, this is part of Jacksonville growing up. If Duval is ever going to become the bold new city of the South and fulfill its potential, it's time to fund the schools, he says. And let's go now to Carol in Jacksonville. Carol, good morning.
I'm concerned about the project management of all these funds because right now, since there haven't been any major projects in the schools in recent years, apparently, project managers will not be on the staff. But as far as I know, the superintendent has not addressed this issue, and so I think it should be brought up.
Okay, Carol, yeah. Thanks for that. And, you know, Ed Pratt Daniels, we have an email from a listener, too. Scott asks, what assurances do we have that the money won't go toward administrative and teacher bonuses, et cetera? What's your response to these concerns?
Well, the first is, by law, it has to be spent on capital improvements. It cannot be spent on salaries for teachers, administrators, or anybody else. It has to be spent on fixed capital expenses. Second of all, the district is going to be hiring project managers in order to make sure that these construction projects are on time and on budget. And there is a prioritized list, as I explained earlier, based on the needs of each of the schools. Now, all the schools will get some security and technology upgrades, but the ones that are in the worst shape will either get major rehabs or, in some cases, have a whole new school built because it's less expensive than trying to bring the old school up to code. And in addition, there's a 24-citizen committee that's going to be appointed by the school board that will be independent and have access to all of the financial information and be able to tell the community that the funds are, in fact, being spent as they were designed.
Thanks for that. Julie tweets the show, the cut for charters was a backroom deal engineered primarily by State Rep Jason Fisher. He has an opponent who values public schools, Ben Marcus. vote yes on the half penny. And if you live in House District 16, vote for Ben Marcus. Okay, these tweets give you an idea of the passion around these issues, how closely people are following this in our community. We want to hear from all sides. Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Personally, I'm not against the half-cent referendum, but I am just kind of curious about what percentage of property taxes go towards the public school. As I drive around all the counties in Northeast Florida, I can't help but notice all the new subdivisions coming in. And I know not every house has children that are in schools. It would just seem to me that through the property tax that people are paying on these newer homes, as more people move into the state, that additional funding ought to make up a significant portion of the shortfall, or am I mistaken in how much money comes from our property tax going to public school?
All right, Mark, thanks for that. Patricia Willis, that caller said, look, you know, I see all this new construction going up, families with disposable income moving in. We need to explain to him a little more fully how school funding is apportioned and why property taxes and rising property values around the region aren't enough to fix this issue. Can you tackle that one?
Well, you're right. We do see the homes coming up in the property tax, and that is a plus for us to be able to receive the additional funding from that. But the property tax alone is not enough for the what we need in order to do the amount of dollars that it will cost for us to be able to tackle what years of years that we have not had been able to address the needs and concerns of these buildings would not be enough with just the property tax. The dollars that we will be able to receive as part of the half penny sales tax will be able to, again, bring in as much as $1.7 million, $1 billion that we'll be looking at over the next 5 years, and so over the next 15 years, and then $1.117 million a year. And so it's much more when we can have a broader base of funding coming in like we would with the half penny sales tax, as opposed to just what we would receive as part of property tax.
All right. With all of that said, Ed Pratt Daniels, it'll be a crowded ballot this November. High turnout expected because Florida will be fulfilling its historic role, most likely, of picking a president. It'll be a close election there in this swing state. So you've got a lot of eyes on this, is what I'm getting at. A lot of people will be looking at this measure on their ballot when they go to vote. Early voting starts in Duval County very soon, less than a month away. Well, actually, just about a month away, Monday, October 19th. So what's your final message to voters when they have this before them on the ballot?
Well, I think how we support our young people is a measure of the quality of the community. Whether or not it's preparing people to do the kinds of jobs we'll need as we age, the person who's going to help me when I get in the hospital and need a highly qualified nurse or a nurse assistant, to people who are going to be doing the construction on our houses, to people who are going to be taking numerous roles that support us as we age. And also, from the standpoint of economic development, there is no better leading indicator than the quality of the workforce. And that's up and down from jobs that might require an advanced degree to those that require a high school degree with some technical training. And so whether or not it's to support young people or support the community and improve the economic condition of the community, one of the things this will do is pump a huge amount of quick money into the economy in the construction area to kind of jumpstart the local economy and put more people back to work. And so to me, it's whether or not it's because you're concerned about the community or just enlightened self-interest that makes sense for me to support this effort and make sure we have modern, safe, and efficient schools.
Well, I want to thank you both, former Duval County School Superintendents Ed Pratt Daniels and Patricia Willis. There's more at the website DuvalCBS.com. That's Citizens for Better Schools. And Ed, Pat, thank you both, and we appreciate your insights.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead, meanwhile, later. Celebrating Arlington, its past, present, and future. We'll tell you about efforts in that neighborhood. But up next.
I don't think Jacksonville was the birthplace of Southern Rock, but I think it was the mother lode.
The Definitive History of Jacksonville and Southern Rock, all inside the pages of a new book. That's after this.
This is David McGowan, CEO of WJCT, and I want to take a moment to say thank you to all of the listeners who joined our community of financial supporters this past week. It is your support that makes all we do possible. Thank you.
Comedian Larry Wilmore has had quite the career, but maybe his most infamous moment came from a single joke he made to President Obama back in 2016.
There was a rallying cry from people who said, "Yes, Larry Wilmore, thank you. That was the blackest thing I've ever seen in my life," you know, of people who really got it and got what I was talking about, which to me was so satisfying.
Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Tomorrow at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, Lynyrd Skynyrd, the Allman Brothers, and many other groups helped usher in a new kind of Southern music here in Jacksonville way back when. Together, they and bands like 38 Special, Molly Hatchet, Blackfoot, and more reset the course of 70s rock. But it was kind of crazy because Jacksonville seemed at first like an unlikely hotbed for this new musical movement. Author Michael Fitzgerald blends eyewitness detail with in-depth history to tell the story of how the River City bred this new generation of legendary musicians. I spoke with him about his new book, Jacksonville and the Roots of Southern Rock.
Hey, Michael, good to be with you. Thanks for joining the show.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Well, we all know about Jacksonville as the birthplace of Southern rock, the Allman Brothers, Lynyrd Skynyrd, but lots of other bands, too, like 38 Special, Molly Hatchet, and more. And this is great to have a book that tells the story of how this city birthed this whole genre of music. Tell me a little bit about how you got interested in this story and what inspired the book.
Well, first of all, I don't mean to contradict you, but I don't think Jacksonville was the birthplace of Southern rock. I think it was, the band was doing it before anybody in Jacksonville thought of doing it. I was in New York, and the Hombres in Memphis, and Delaney and Bonnie in Los Angeles. I don't think Jacksonville was the birthplace of Southern rock, but I think it was the mother lode.
Mm.
Your question was how I got interested in this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I grew up here. I moved here when I was 15 years old, and I was a music nut, and it was just the most happening place you could possibly imagine. And I was in the middle of quite a few of these events that took place, and pretty much everybody I know that's been in Jacksonville a long time is very proud of the city's musical output.
So you were at some of the early live performances of, say, Lynyrd Skynyrd or the Allman Brothers? Is that what you're getting at?
Oh, God, yes. I saw Dwayne Allman sitting in with the Second Coming, which was a group from Bradenton that had moved to Jacksonville. I saw Dwayne Allman sitting in with them at the Woodstock Youth Center on Beaver Street in March of 1969. And my friend and I were heckling him because we wanted to hear Dickie Betts play.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Lynyrd Skynyrd many, many times. I saw them at the Cedar Hills Youth Association, which we call the Sugar Bowl. I saw them the night Ronnie Van Zant asked the audience what they thought about changing the name of the group to Lynyrd Skynyrd after their PE coach at Lee High School. And I looked over, I thought he was goofing. I looked over at a guy next to me, I said, "Who's Lynyrd Skynyrd?"
And that became the famous name. Wow. How cool is that? So you have some great memories of those days.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. And no, you know, none of us ever thought this was going to be historical.
Yeah, you just were going to see a local band at the time. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what's cool about your book, too, is that you look, you obviously love the music, you know the music, but you write about the music as the soundtrack to a whole way of life, a whole lifestyle. Not just in Jacksonville, but really the whole country. You capture a time. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, I had to really analyze the term Southern rock, and I really had to start with the term rock. What did that mean? Because people think rock and roll and rock are synonymous, but really they're not. Rock was something that came in, I think the guys at Rolling Stone, the writers at Rolling Stone or Cream, called the underground music in 68, the hippie music. They called it rock as distinct from rock and roll, which was a 50s thing. And so I had to pinpoint what rock meant. So rock was music for hippies. And so Southern rock was music for the Southern hippies. And, you know, we did have a lot of those here in Jacksonville, and they had them in Atlanta. But they were, you know, a breed apart back in 1968. So they called it underground music at the time. So, you know, a Southern hippie was a pretty rare bird.
Would that be someone like, say, Graham Parsons, who you write about?
Yeah, I would think so. A long-haired country boy, he definitely was one. He lived in Jacksonville. He lived in Ponte Vedra. He did some recording here. He was on the radio here. I think we can claim him.
We can claim him. Now, your book comes out at an interesting time because, of course, there's a proposed Museum of Southern Rock that's going to be put together downtown by the Jacksonville Historical Society. They're even asking people to submit their proposed names for this museum. What would you call this museum?
I've tried very hard to convince these people not to call it the Museum of Southern Rock or dedicate it to Southern Rock because, you know, I mean, I do like Southern Rock, but there's so much other music from Jacksonville. It's phenomenal. I mean, we have every kind of music, certainly a lot of R&B and black music, and if we focus on Southern Rock, I feel it's going to sort of shut the other artists, important artists, out. I don't know what I would call it. I would guess maybe North Florida Music Hall of Fame or something to that effect, or you know what I mean? Because there have been so many other types of music from this town.
Absolutely, and the La Villa neighborhood was where Ray Charles first performed, and there are so many stories.
Ray Charles lived at 753 West Church Street, where La Villa School of the Arts is now.
Exactly. So what's it like then to publish a book about this incredible musical tradition at the time that the city is finally getting serious about embracing this tradition and really using it as a way to even spark tourism?
I don't understand why it's taken them so long to do this, but I'm grateful for it. Todd Rubin at the City's Film and Television Commission has always been behind promoting Jacksonville, you know, as a music town. But I don't know. It's never really been properly exploited, I don't think. And there's, you know, political reasons for that.
Hmm. Well, I guess better late than never. And it's exciting to have this book out now, being so well reviewed by Publishers Weekly and others. Check it out, the new book, Jacksonville and the Roots of Southern Rock, out now from University Press of Florida. Author Michael Ray Fitzgerald, good to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Melissa, I really appreciate your interest, and thanks for helping promote Jacksonville music.
Well, the community group Arlington 2020 is hosting a three-day festival this weekend to celebrate the neighborhood's past, present, and future. And they're also going to acknowledge the fruits of a five-year effort to build up infrastructure in Arlington and spark greater investment in that neighborhood. Dr. Joy Hervey is CEO of Arlington 2020 and is on the line. Dr. Hervey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. In a moment, I can't wait to hear all about the festival. But first, let's talk about what's been happening in Arlington over the last several years. There's been this concerted effort to really beef up the neighborhood, improve it. It's one of those older sort of inner ring neighborhoods, like so many around America, that used to be this sparkling middle class suburb, but then started to fall off in recent decades. And now the residents are pulling it back. Tell us about what's been happening in Arlington.
Sure. So in 2015, Impact Church decided to take the lead on creating a partnership that would create measurable change in Arlington by the year 2020. We knew that the government couldn't be relied upon to do everything that was necessary. And so we began this initiative by bringing together partners that were doing great work in Arlington so that we could coordinate our efforts and put together a plan that really would help to structure the work. And it was really a great moment because Jacksonville University was doing some great things in Arlington. The city of Jacksonville had begun a Renew Arlington initiative that would later become a community redevelopment area. JTA and JEA were investing in the community. And so it was really just a great synergy. And we decided to focus our efforts around five focus areas: community empowerment, family strengthening, economic development, housing development, and workforce development, and created a 20-point plan. And so since that time, we've seen investment improve in Arlington. Anyone who drives through can see that housing is increasing. We've had over 1,000 new housing units built in Arlington. And over $300 million in capital investments, including some investments in our parks and infrastructure.
What are some examples of changes people can see with their own eyes when they are in the neighborhood?
Sure. So one of the things that we've really been focusing on is our commercial corridor. And so if you drive down Arlington Expressway, University Boulevard, Merrill Road, you'll see some new businesses that are cropping up there. And what's really exciting about that is that the tax investment that those businesses inject into the community goes right back into Arlington through our CRA. And so the Old Town and Country Shopping Center has been purchased and is under redevelopment now, and that's really kind of a jewel of Arlington and a gateway into the community, and there's some very visible improvements happening there. There's also been some new improvement at the intersection of Port Carolina University, and Regency Mall is under construction. So anyone who drives past there will see that there's a new anchor there, which is Impact Church, that will be opening before the end of this year. So there's some very visible commercial improvements that are happening in our commercial corridors.
Anyone driving along the Arlington Expressway that comes off the Matthews Bridge can see that gorgeous new Arlington mural, too.
We love that. The mural at College Park is really just a jewel in terms of public art in our city, and it's become a landmark. So folks are welcome to come and take pictures in front of the mural. And during our festival, we'll actually be having a ribbon cutting for that mural on Saturday morning.
So tell us what's happening this weekend. A big festival in Arlington called Celebrate Arlington, Friday through Sunday. What's on tap?
Yeah, so we're so excited. This is our first inaugural festival to really draw attention to the great things that are happening in Arlington and really the great history that's a part of that community. And so we'll start on Friday night with a virtual 2020 Vision Summit, which is a town hall type meeting that's interactive. We'll have some community development professionals from all over the country who are part of a panel and sharing best practices, and then we'll invite the community to share their ideas. And then on Saturday morning, we'll have a 5K that starts and ends at College Park right in front of that gorgeous mural, and it winds through historic Arlington. Folks can run or walk that, and there's a virtual option as well. And then that night, we're so excited about our virtual Sock Hop and awards gala. So that'll be hosted by Don Lopez, and it will include music by the Chris Thomas Band, and just awards for Arlington Arlington Champions that night, and anyone can watch that on Facebook Live on the Arlington 2020 page. And then Sunday is our drive-in picnic at Regency Mall in the parking lot, so folks can stay in their vehicles, get a free meal, and enjoy some entertainment from the main stage.
Wow, lots happening. So you really are encouraging people to come out and do at least one of these activities. And these could be folks that haven't been in this neighborhood in many years, right?
Exactly. So we're really drawing people into the new Arlington is what we're calling it, and changing the narrative. So what folks have heard about Arlington, we invite you to come and check it out and do it in a safe way. So we've planned all of these events in partnership with the city and with our health department to make sure that they're safe and that folks can have a great time and stay healthy as well.
Where can people learn more about all of this? Maybe they're listening to this on the fly and they didn't catch all the details.
Sure. So they can go to eventbrite.com and search for Celebrate Arlington. Tickets are available there, and several of the events are free, but we just ask that you register in advance. They can go to our website, which is arlington2020jax.org, or call us at 339-5125, and we'll be happy to point you in the right direction.
All right. Well, it's the Celebrate Arlington Festival, Friday through Sunday in Arlington. This is an initiative of Revitalize Arlington, Inc. and Arlington 2020, and she is CEO, Dr. Joy Hervey. Dr. Hervey, have a great time, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A quick break, and in a moment, you would not believe how many families in this area cannot afford diapers for their children. We'll tell you about the First Coast's new diaper bank and how you can donate to it. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
I'm Michelle Corum, and I host the news. I wake up around 4 o'clock, and the show is live at 6 in the morning. So for the next 3 hours, I'm on about every 10 minutes. I have only myself to pull together whatever might be breaking and get it fit to read on the air. You want to be fast, but you want to be accurate. So it's important not to rush to air until you're certain what's going on. That's our philosophy. This is WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you more than just a day's news.
Well, the poor old British pub has been around for 2,000 years.
We introduce you to people around the globe.
I'm a Liberian, but I'm part of Africa.
If we were only in Argentina.
I think it's a Scottish thing, you know? This sense of doom there, but it's always kind of amusing to us.
Join us and hear The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
Florida folk musician Frank Thomas has passed away. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will remember Frank Thomas, who along with Gamble Rogers and Will McLean was one of the great Florida troubadours. We'll discuss the Jacksonville Times Union and Florida rock musician Tom Petty. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
Effective land management can help us fight megafires. One tool, fire itself. That is,
fire that is on the landscape to help keep that landscape and ecosystem healthy.
I'm Molly Wood, the tools and economics of fire prevention. Next time on Marketplace.
Tomorrow night at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
It's time to listen to each other, to people you disagree with, to people you respect, to people you've never heard of, to people across America. It's time to listen to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the pandemic has shown all of us just how vulnerable so many families are, as millions are struggling right now to meet basic needs. That includes diapers. Yes, diapers. They're pretty expensive. And if you've got a baby, you can't do without them. Now, there is a new diaper bank in town to help thousands of new parents out there. Crystal Parks is founder and president of the Diaper Bank of Northeast Florida. Hi, Crystal. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So as we talk about National Diaper Awareness Week, there is such a thing. I'm excited to highlight your organization, which you founded, the Diaper Bank for Northeast Florida. What is the purpose of the Diaper Bank?
Yeah, so the Diaper Bank for Northeast Florida is a new nonprofit here in Jacksonville, and our focus is on addressing diaper need. And we do that by collecting, storing, and distributing diapers to other social service agencies and their clients who have the greatest need for diapers. And so our focus is, again, on diaper need, which is the lack of a sufficient supply of diapers to keep a baby clean, dry, and healthy. And so I got the idea to start the diaper bank last year, and because of COVID, requests for diapers have certainly increased, and so the timing couldn't have been more perfect to start this new initiative.
Yeah. I mean, according to the National Diaper Bank Network, one in three families experiences a diaper need, an insufficient supply of diapers. I raised two kids. I went through a lot of diapers. Disposable diapers are really expensive. And so, you know, this is a big cost for people. You learned a lot about this when you worked at the Gateway Center, correct? When you would try to collect diapers for women, mothers staying there?
Yes. Prior to becoming a stay-at-home mom, I worked for Gateway Community Services as a fundraiser. And when I made the transition to become a stay-at-home mom, I went to Gateway to visit and drop off some of my son's baby clothes. And that's when a discussion came up that the biggest need for the women in their treatment program was diapers. And so I knew immediately that was something I wanted to help with. And so that kind of led me to research doing diaper drives and connecting with other diaper banks in our area. And when I did a quick Google search, I realized there were no diaper banks here in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. And I knew this was something I just definitely wanted to do, and I contacted the National Diaper Bank Network, and they have been awesome in supporting me in my efforts in starting this nonprofit organization.
That's great, and you've been partnering with other organizations around town too, correct?
Yes, Gateway Community Services was my first partner agency, and now I am helping to support Family Promise of Jacksonville, Community Health Outreach, the Cloth Option, which is a national organization dedicated to connecting families with cloth diaper options, and also Jacksonville Young Lives organization.
Wow, lots of groups. At your website, which is jacksdiaperbank.com, people can look there and find a number of places where they can drop off diapers. any size diapers. You also want people to host their own diaper drive, correct?
Correct. And we understand due to COVID, some may not be comfortable holding an in-person diaper drive. So we do offer the option to host a virtual diaper drive. And I'm available to help them set up their peer-to-peer fundraising page and offer them a diaper drive toolkit that'll help them walk through the different stages of hosting a successful diaper drive.
And as you mentioned a few minutes ago, the need was great to begin with, right? But the pandemic has made it even more critical.
It has. For example, my partner agency, Community Health Outreach, prior to COVID was serving somewhere between 100 and 200 children, and now the need is at 400.
Wow.
They've been one of my great partners. We've been working together to do a big community awareness piece, especially around just the issue of diaper need, but also what COVID made worse for many families.
It has made it worse. $100 a month per child to buy disposable diapers, according to the National Diaper Bank Network. And families that can't afford it will let their child go diaperless, or they'll let a child stay in a dirty diaper longer. That can open up all kinds of potential health risks. So this is just a simple way to help people in need and improve the public health of this whole community. So go to the website, jacksdiaperbank.com. Learn more about this critical need and donate to the Diaper Bank for Northeast Florida. And I want to thank you so much, Crystal, for founding it and for sharing all of this information with us. She's Crystal Parks, founder president of the Diaper Bank for Northeast Florida. Again, it's jacksdiaperbank.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Heather Schatz's kids are out of diapers, too. We don't miss those days, quite frankly. Josh Torres is show director. Jessica Palumbo has one baby about to leave diapers, but another one on the way. So we're waiting for that new arrival. And Bill Bortsfield's kids are grown. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great Monday, everyone. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow and connect with you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.